God when it came to past English injustices in the region. An ancient woman, whom they judged to be 100 years old, made a point of seeking out the pilgrims because she never saw English. As soon as she set eyes on them, she burst into tears, weeping and crying excessively. They learned that 3 of her sons had been captured 7 years before by Thomas Hunt, and she still mourned their loss. "We told them we were sorry that any Englishman should give them that offense," Winslow wrote, "that Hunt was a bad man and that all the English that heard of it condemned him for the same." Iono and several others offered to accompany them to Nauset, about 20 miles to the east. Unlike the winter before, when the shores of Cape Cod had been empty of people, the pilgrims found Indians almost everywhere they looked. They now realized why the Naussets had felt compelled to attack them. By setting up camp near First Encounter Beach, they had ventured into the very midst of them. They brought the shallop to within wading distance of shore and were soon approached by a huge number of Indians. Given their past history in this place, the pilgrims ordered the crowd to back away from the boat. They could only hope that their alliance with Massasoit ensured their safety. Keeping their muskets ready, they insisted that only 2 Indians approach at a time. One of the first to come forward was the man whose corn they had stolen. The pilgrims arranged to have him visit their settlement, where they promised to reimburse him for his loss. It was growing dark by the time the Nauset sachem, Aspinet, arrived with more than 100 men, many of whom had undoubtedly participated in the first encounter back in December. Half the warriors remained on shore with their bows and arrows, while the others waded out to the boat unarmed. One of Aspinet's men carried Francis Billington in his arms. Looking none the worse for his time in captivity, the teenager wore a string of shell beads around his neck. The pilgrims presented Aspinet with a knife, and peace was declared between the 2 peoples. From the pilgrims' perspective, it was a great relief to have finally righted the wrongs they'd committed during their first anxious and confusing weeks in America. But Aspinet had some disturbing news. The Narragansetts were said to have killed several of Massasoit's men and taken their leader captive. "This struck some fear in us," Winslow wrote. "If the Narragansetts should decide to attack their settlement, it would be a catastrophe. There were only about 6 men back at Plymouth. They must return as quickly as possible. If Massasoit had indeed been captured, they were, according to the terms of the treaty they had recently signed, at war with the most powerful tribe in the region." Massasoit had indeed been taken, temporarily, it turned out, by the Narragansetts. But they soon learned that their greatest threat was not from the Narragansetts, but from the Poconokets' supposed allies. For the lesser sachems who had opposed Massasoit's treaty with the pilgrims, this was just the opportunity they had been looking for. One sachem in particular, Corbetant, from the village of Mattapoisett, just to the east of Massasoit's headquarters at Sowams, was attempting to use the sachem's troubles to break the Poconoket-English alliance. Corbetant had arrived at the nearby village of Nemasket and was now attempting to draw the hearts of Massasoit's subjects from him. Bradford decided to send Squanto and Tokamahamon to Nemasket to find out what Corbetant was up to. The next day, one of Massasoit's men, a warrior named Habamuck, arrived at Plymouth, gasping for breath and covered in sweat. He'd just run the 15 miles from Nemasket, and he had terrible news. Squanto, he feared, was dead. When Habamuck had last seen the interpreter, one of Corbetant's warriors had been holding a knife to his chest. Corbetant quite rightly viewed Squanto as the instigator of Massasoit's shift toward the pilgrims. If Squanto was dead, Corbetant told the Indians at Nemasket, the English had lost their tongue. Bradford immediately called a meeting of his advisors. The pilgrims were men of God, but this did not mean they were loath to use force. For more than 1.5 millennia, Christians had looked to the scriptures to sanction just about every conceivable act of violence. Moses had led the Jews to the Promised Land, but there had also been Joshua, a warrior king who had fought to uphold his people's claims. undoubtedly counseling Bradford to take immediate and forceful action, was the Pilgrims Joshua Miles Standish. This was their chance to show the Indians the consequences of challenging the English, either directly or indirectly through one of their emissaries. "It was conceived not fit to be born," Bradford wrote, "for if the Pilgrims should suffer their friends and messengers thus to be wronged, they should have none would cleave to them, or give them any intelligence, or do them service afterwards, but next they would fall upon themselves." They decided to hit Corbetant quickly and to hit him hard. Standish volunteered to lead 10 men on a mission to Nemasket. If Squanto had in fact been killed, they were to seize Corbetant. And since he'd been disloyal to Massasoit, he was to suffer the fate of all notorious traitors in Jacobean England. Standish was to cut off his head and bring it back to Plymouth for public display. They left the next morning, Tuesday, August 14th, with Habermock as their guide. Habermock was named for the same mysterious spirit of darkness as Squanto was. But unlike Squanto, Habermock was a Panisse, a warrior of special abilities and stamina. It was said a Panisse could not be killed in battle, who was responsible for collecting tribute for his sachem. From the start, Standish and Habermock had much in common, and the two warriors quickly became good friends. Soon after leaving Plymouth, it began to rain. About 3 miles from Nemasket, they ventured off the trail and waited for dark. In the summer rain, Standish briefed his men on his plan. Habermock was to lead them to Corbetant's wigwam around midnight. Once Standish had positioned them around the dwelling, he and Habermock would charge inside and take Corbetant. The men were instructed to shoot any Indians who attempted to escape. For those with no previous military experience, it was a terrifying prospect, and Standish did his best to instill some confidence in his ragtag commando unit. Soon, all men were encouraging one another to the utmost of their power. After a last quick meal, it was time for the assault. In the starless dark, Habermock directed them to the wigwam. The dwelling was probably larger than most, with a considerable number of men, women, and children inside, sleeping on the low platforms built along the interior walls. By this late hour, the central fire had dwindled to a few glowing embers. The drum of rain on the wigwam's reed mats masked the sounds of the Pilgrims taking their positions. Standish burst in, shouting Corbetant's name. It was very dark inside, and with Habermock acting as his interpreter, the Pilgrim captain demanded to know where the petty sachem was. But the people inside the wigwam were too terror-stricken to speak. Some leaped off their sleeping platforms and attempted to force their way through the matted walls of the wigwam. Soon the guards outside were shooting off their muskets as the people inside screamed and wept. Several women clung to Habermock, calling him friend. What had been intended as a bold lightning strike against the enemy was threatening to become a chaotic exercise in futility. Gradually they learned that Corbetant had been at Nemasket, but no one was sure where he was now. They also learned that Squanto was still alive. Habermock pulled himself up through the wigwam's smoke hole and, balancing himself on the roof, called out for the interpreter. Tokamahamon, it turned out, was also alive and well. The next morning they discovered that Corbetant and his men had fled, probably for their home at Mattapoisett. Standish delivered a message to the residents of Nemasket. "Although Corbetant had now escaped us, yet there was no place should secure him and his from us if he continued his threatening us." A man and a woman had been wounded in the melee that night, and the Pilgrims offered to bring them back to Plymouth for medical attention. The following day, the settlement's self-taught surgeon, Samuel Fuller, tended to the Indians' injuries, and they were free to return home. Over the next few weeks, Bradford began to learn of the reaction to Standish's midnight raid. Just as his military officer had predicted, the show of force, no matter how confused, had won the Pilgrims some new respect. Several petty sachems sent their gratulations to Governor Bradford. Epinal, the Martha's Vineyard sachem who had attacked Dermer, made overtures of friendship. Even Corbitant let it be known that he now wanted to make peace. By this time, Massasoit was back in Soames, and with the Pilgrims having proven themselves to be loyal and resolute supporters, a much firmer peace existed throughout the region. On September 13th, 9 sachems, including Corbitant, Epinal, Massasoit's brother, Quatakina, and Canacom, the sachem who had sent Francis Billington to the Nossets, journeyed to Plymouth to sign a treaty professing their loyalty to King James. About this time, Bradford determined that an exploratory expedition should be sent north to the land of the Massachusetts. Squanto had warned them that the Massachusetts, who lived in the vicinity of modern Boston, had often threatened us. It was time to bring them into the fold as well. They soon discovered where they should have settled. As they sailed their shallop across the island-speckled immensity of modern Boston Harbor, they were filled with envy. Instead of the shallow reaches of Plymouth Harbor, here was a place where ships of any size could venture right up to land. Instead of Little Town Brook, there were 3 navigable rivers converging at an easily defensible neck of high ground known as Shawmut. This was a place where an English settlement might blossom into a major port, with rivers providing access to the fur-rich interior of New England. Not surprisingly, the Indians in the region, who had been devastated by both disease and war with the rival tribes to the north, possessed many more furs than the Pilgrims had so far found among the Poconocets. But the thought of relocating themselves after so much loss and sacrifice was too much to bear. They decided to stay put. It would be left to others to transform this place into the city on a hill called Boston. The Pilgrims' ambitions were more modest. They were quite content with a village by a brook. The important thing was their spiritual life, and for that to flourish as it once had in Leiden, they needed their minister, John Robinson, and the rest of the congregation to join them there in the New World. We do not know the exact date of the celebration we now call the First Thanksgiving, but it was probably in late September or early October, soon after their crop of corn, squash, beans, barley, and peas had been harvested. It was also a time during which Plymouth Harbor played host to a tremendous number of migrating birds, particularly ducks and geese, and Bradford ordered 4 men to go out fowling. It took only a few hours for Plymouth's hunters to kill enough ducks and geese to feed the settlement for a week. Now that they had gathered the fruit of our labors, Bradford declared it time to rejoice together after a more special manner. The term Thanksgiving, first applied in the 19th century, was not used by the Pilgrims themselves. For the Pilgrims, a Thanksgiving was a time of spiritual devotion. Since just about everything the Pilgrims did had religious overtones, there was certainly much about the gathering in the fall of 1621 that would have made it a proper Puritan Thanksgiving. But as Winslow's description makes clear, there was also much about the gathering that was similar to a traditional English harvest festival, a secular celebration that dated back to the Middle Ages in which villagers ate, drank, and played games. Countless Victorian-era engravings notwithstanding, the Pilgrims did not spend the day sitting around a long table draped with a white linen cloth, clasping each other's hands in prayer as a few curious Indians looked on. Instead of an English affair, the First Thanksgiving soon became an overwhelmingly native celebration when Massasoit and 100 Poconocets, more than twice the entire English population of Plymouth, arrived at the settlement with 5 freshly killed deer. Even if all the Pilgrims' furniture was brought out into the sunshine, most of the celebrants stood, squatted, or sat on the ground as they clustered around outdoor fires where the deer and birds turned on wooden spits and where pottages, stews into which varieties of meats and vegetables were thrown, simmered invitingly. In addition to ducks and deer, there was, according to Bradford, a good store of wild turkeys in the fall of 1621. Turkeys were by no means a novelty to the Pilgrims. When the conquistadors arrived in Mexico in the 16th century, they discovered that the Indians of Central America possessed domesticated turkeys as well as gold. The birds were imported to Spain as early as the 1520s, and by the 1540s, they had reached England. By 1575, the domesticated Central American turkey had become a fixture at English Christmases. The wild turkeys of New England were bigger and much faster than the birds the pilgrims had known in Europe, and were often pursued in winter when they could be tracked in the snow. The pilgrims may have also added fish to their meal of birds and deer. In fall, striped bass, bluefish, and cod were abundant. Perhaps most important to the pilgrims was that with a recently harvested barley crop, it was now possible to brew beer. Alas, the pilgrims were without pumpkin pies or cranberry sauce. There were also no forks, which did not appear at Plymouth until the last decades of the 17th century. The pilgrims ate with their fingers and their knives. Neither Bradford nor Winslow mention it, but the first Thanksgiving coincided with what was, for the pilgrims, a new and startling phenomenon, the turning of the green leaves of summer to the incandescent yellows, reds, and purples of a New England autumn. With the shortening of the days comes a diminishment in the amount of green chlorophyll in the tree leaves, which allows the other pigments contained within the leaves to emerge. In Britain, the cloudy fall days and warm nights cause the autumn colors to be muted and lackluster. In New England, on the other hand, the profusion of sunny fall days and cool but not freezing nights unleashes the colors latent within the tree leaves, with oaks turning red, brown, and russet, hickories golden brown, birches yellow, red maples scarlet, sugar maples orange, and black maples glowing yellow. It was a display that must have contributed to the enthusiasm with which the pilgrims later wrote of the festivities that fall. The first Thanksgiving marked the conclusion of a remarkable year. 11 months earlier, the pilgrims had arrived at the tip of Cape Cod, fearful and uninformed. They had spent the next month alienating and angering every Native American they happened to come across. By all rights, none of the pilgrims should have emerged from the first winter alive. Like the French sailors before them, they all might have been either killed or taken captive by the Indians. That it had worked out differently was a testament not only to the pilgrims' grit, resolve, and faith, but to their ability to take advantage of an extraordinary opportunity. During the winter of 1621, the survival of the English settlement had been in the balance. Massasoit's decision to offer them assistance had saved the pilgrims' lives in the short term, but there had already been several instances in which the sachems' generosity could all have gone for naught. Placing their faith in God, the pilgrims might have insisted on a policy of arrogant isolationism. But by becoming an active part of the diplomatic process in southern New England, by sending Winslow and Hopkins to Soames, by compensating the Naussets for the corn, and most important, by making clear their loyalty to Massasoit at the hurly-burly in Nemasket, they had taken charge of their own destiny in the region. In 1620, New England was far from being a paradise of abundance and peace. Indeed, the New World was, in many ways, much like the old, a place where generations of over-farming had worn out the soil, a place where disease and war were omnipresent threats. There were profound differences between the Pilgrims and Pokanokets, to be sure, especially when it came to technology, culture, and spiritual beliefs. But in these early years, when the mutual challenge of survival dominated all other concerns, the two peoples had more in common than is generally appreciated today. For the Pilgrims, some of whom had slept in a wigwam, and all of whom had enjoyed eating and drinking with the Indians during that first Thanksgiving, these were not a despicable pack of barbarians, even if some of their habits, such as their refusal to wear clothes, struck them as savage. These were human beings, much like themselves, very trustworthy, quick of apprehension, ripe-witted, just, according to Edward Winslow. For his part, Massasoit had managed one of the more wondrous comebacks of all time. Scorned and humiliated by the Narragansetts, he had found a way to give his people, who were now just a fraction of the Narragansetts in terms of population, a kind of parity with the rival tribe. Massasoit.